Good morning again. It is a pleasure to be here. I was very grateful to be able to talk to you a little bit about the work in Philadelphia, but I'm even greater to talk to you about something from the Word of God. And so it's my pleasure to share with you some of the things that I've studied. And specifically, we're going to be talking about, in this short meeting, about the book of Daniel. We don't have a lot of time during our a half-week meeting, and so I've tried to pick and choose some chapters that would be encouraging to our life as Christians, and some things that hopefully will be challenging to us as well. To this morning, we're going to be talking about Daniel chapter 1. If you want to start opening up your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1, we'll be reading from there. This afternoon, we're going to look at Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar's dream and his humiliation. Tomorrow night, if you can be with us again, Daniel chapter 6 and the lion's den is what we'll discuss. Tuesday night, we'll talk about Daniel, his prayer, his confession, and the things that are revealed to Daniel in Daniel chapter 9. And then on the fifth night, or on the fifth occasion that I'll be able to talk to you about the book of Daniel on Wednesday, I'm going to do a brief overview of the prophetic content of the book of Daniel and talk about its implications about the inspiration of the scriptures, what we can learn there, and how we can be encouraged by that. So I hope that you'll be here at every occasion. I'm hoping that we can grow together and be encouraged together during this week. Daniel is... Before we get into the book itself, I'd like to just do a brief overview of the context. And maybe to some of you, this will be kind of something that you've discussed on another occasion. But it's always good to have a reminder of the historical context of these books. If we remember in Israelite history, there was a time when all of this kingdom was united under one kingship. Saul was the first king, then David, then Solomon. But then Solomon's son, Rehoboam, was a very unwise king. And because of his bad choices, and really because of Solomon's bad choices, the kingdom split into two parts. Israel to the north, Judah to the south. Israel, as a kingdom, was wicked from the very beginning. Jeroboam, the first king, was brought in an idol, brought in the golden calves, and they were very wicked. And as a result of their idolatry, God said, "You are not going to live in the land of promise anymore," and sent the nation of Assyria to punish them and to take them physically out of their homes to the land of Assyria into captivity. And that's where they are. That's where they're taken. Judah was a little bit better. Maybe we could say that they had some good kings that tried to persuade the people to listen to God instead of their own hearts, instead of the idols. They had the temple there in Jerusalem, and so that was a blessing to keep them thoughtful of Yahweh and His bidding. But they, like their cousins to the north, listened to the nations around them, and they became idolatrous as well. And very quickly, they too, after Assyrian captivity, they were taken away by the nation of Babylon to a Babylonian captivity. And that's where we find the context of the book of Daniel. And they were in captivity there for 70 years. It's helpful to me to keep some of these dates in mind. And it might be a good thing to write down at the back of your Bible. Because several of these dates or several of these groups that were taken away correspond with some of the books of the Bible that we have. For example, when Jerusalem was destroyed, it was not destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in all one sweeping motion, but rather there were evidently three groups that were taken. First of all, there were was a group that we can associate Daniel with in 605 BC, where Nebuchadnezzar wins the battle of Carchemish, and then he goes back home, and while he's going back home, evidently he takes Daniel and some of his friends and many other young Jews back to Babylon. The second group is taken away in 597 BC that we can associate with the prophet Ezekiel. He's taken away to Babylon, and he prophesies there from Babylon. And then finally, in 586 BC is when Jerusalem was finally destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. He is fed up with the rebelliousness of this nation, and he destroys them, and the people of Jerusalem suffer. Jeremiah was there to see all of this. It's helpful to me to associate then these three prophets, Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel. They're contemporaries. They talk about the same period of time, although from different perspectives. Daniel, of course, he talks from Babylon. Ezekiel prophesies from Babylon, but they prophesy then, or they work in two different really contexts. Daniel is in the upper echelon of the counselors of the king Nebuchadnezzar, and then Ezekiel, he is among the people. But both of them are in Babylon. Jeremiah, however, is still in Jerusalem, and his prophecies are given there from Jerusalem, and he witnesses how God judges this people, and he is there to encourage them not to disobey God and rebel against God. But all three of these prophets then are contemporaries with one another. And I think that's important to remember and helps us to remember what these books are about. In Daniel chapter 1 is where we find out that the three friends, Daniel and his three friends, are taken away from their home in Jerusalem and are taken away to Babylon. Let's read in chapter 1, verses 1 through 2. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the king of the house of God, and he brought them into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered them to teach them literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food, from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among these were from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. What would it be like to be taken away from your home and transported by force to a country that you do not know? Where they do not speak your language, where the customs are not your customs, where the food is tremendously different, just everything is different. I think that would be hard to imagine. But here is Daniel and his friends being taken out of their home in Jerusalem and transported 800 miles by foot, by camel, I don't know what type of transportation they used, but all the way to Babylon. Thinking all of this time and missing Jerusalem, missing their parents, and missing the life that they were going to have in Jerusalem, but they were going to have a new life. And they were welcomed then in Babylon to this. Welcome to your new home. That's not the most appealing picture that I can think of. I was with the brethren last week in Odessa. It was really kind of hard for them to understand how bad this would be, because that looks a lot like Odessa, but this is modern day Iraq. But I think here in the hill country, this would be horrible. How would you could you imagine going and this is going to be your new home? No trees, not anything, and everything is different. And it's not like you're a free man to go here and go there. You're going to be a slave for the rest of your life here in Babylon. That would be difficult. However, I wonder if my representation of Daniel's Babylon is a little bit extreme. Because on one hand, I'm sure that Daniel and his friends would not have chosen to go to Babylon. I'm sure that his parents, in fact, are distraught that their children are being forced to go to somewhere where they really don't want to go. But really, I wonder if for Daniel and his friends, the captivity was not that bad. Now, hear me out. When Daniel has to go to Babylon, I put up the worst picture that I could find. But that was not the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar. When Daniel comes to Babylon, he's not coming to some podunk country village out in the middle of nowhere. He's coming to Babylon, the capital of the world. He's coming to the place where it is fabled that Nebuchadnezzar built his hanging gardens, gardens that would be suspended from pillars with channels of water that are channeled to it from the Euphrates River. Something that one of the seven wonders of the world. We think the pyramids are great. Well, this was evidently on par with those pyramids. So here comes Daniel, not to this scene of what have I gotten myself into. Rather, he's coming to this miraculous image of what this man has done. And not only is it a wonderful place of lushness, it's the capital of the world. He's going to be living here in the capital of the world. If you want to be successful in life, if you want your business to do really well, at least in a lot of countries, where do you move? You gotta go to the capital. You gotta go to the large cities, and there is where all the commerce, the economy moves. If you want to be an important person, that's where you want to be. Not only is it the capital of the world, but look how Daniel and his friends are treated. Sure, they're driven around at the point of a sword, but they're not treated as slaves in the sense that we might be thinking of. Instead, they are chosen because they are the most beautiful people in Jerusalem. They're chosen because they're the most intelligent. And everybody knows that they're going to be treated and they're going to be suited and given this position. They're going to be trained there, attending the best universities of all the... How would you feel, parents, if one day, knock, knock, knock at the door, and Harvard University is standing there saying, we would like to give a full ride scholarship to your son because he is so intelligent. Well, I don't know what you feel about Harvard, but I think that would be a huge honor, at least, to have that invitation, wouldn't it? How would you feel about that? And now these boys, these young men, they're going to a place where they are going to receive an education that not many young men are going to be able to receive. This is the best of the best. And they're going to be learning the universal language. When I was in Guatemala, all of the Guatemalans would ask, how do you say this in English? How do you say this in English? And so many people would be signing up for English courses and everybody wanted to learn English. Why? Because it was the universal language in so many countries. And the thought is that if you can just learn some English, you're going to get ahead in life. Here they are in Babylon. They're going to learn the language of the Babylonians. And this is the universal language for commerce and for politics during this time. What an opportunity this is for them. And they're going to be eating the king's choice food. The king's not going to be eating ramen noodles. He's not going to be eating beans and rice every night. This is going to be excellent. Could you imagine? I don't know how old Daniel is, but if he's a 16-year-old, I know exactly what he is thinking. If all these young men are coming and they are being given this pork roast on a plate, and they have never eaten, seen, they've never smelt anything so good. This is what the king eats. Isn't that an opportunity that any young man is going to enjoy? And not only that, they're going to be working as the king's counselors. Sure, they're slaves. Sure, they can't. But not just any slave. They're going to be entitled to counsel the king of the empire. Again, how would you feel if one of the senators from the United States Senate calls you up and says, I need some advice. Would you come and work by my right hand so that you can advise me with your wisdom? Well, again, I don't know what you feel about politics, but that would be just a huge honor. You would feel wonderful that you could sit in this powerful position as a counselor to the king. Also, we're going to change your name. Well, that's kind of weird. But you know what? You can call me whatever you want. Just pass me more of those pork chops. Now, what I'm trying to do with all of this is what? Is show you that Daniel's situation, while we can consider that it would be a very difficult thing to move away from his family, there are also some glitter behind this. There were some nice things behind this, and especially when we talk about the subject of this chapter, that the king's choice food, this is not just throwing away, oh, I don't like that anyway. This is something that smells good, it looks good, and everybody's eating it around you. And you have the temptation to do what? Well, hey, while I'm here, these things might look like blessings in disguise. But what we can see in all of this, especially with the change of names, is something sly that Nebuchadnezzar is doing by inviting this young man into his presence. Especially by changing his name, you can see that what Nebuchadnezzar is doing is not just giving them blessings, showering them with gifts, but he's trying to change who these young men are. He's trying to change their identity. For example, the names of these young men. What does Daniel mean? Daniel, what a wonderful name. Daniel means, God is my judge. It's a wonderful name. Hananiah, Yahweh is merciful. Mishael, who is like God? Azariah, Yahweh has helped. Aren't those good names? Now to us as Americans, we don't choose names based on their significance, do we? You know, at one point, I think I did know the significance or the meaning of all of the names of my children. But I think if we went down the list, I don't know if I could tell you anymore what their names mean. Basically, I have names for my children to separate one from the other, and I get them confused still. But the names, we use names because they sound cool, and they sound nice, and they sound, well, that reminds me of Aunt So-and-so, or Uncle So-and-so, who reminds me. But the meaning is kind of lost on us. Not for Daniel and his friends. In fact, you could tell something about Daniel and his friends just by knowing the meaning of their names. What could you tell? These are God-fearing people, weren't they? And you could tell something about their parents as well, that they were people who feared God, that God was the most important, because in their names themselves, they wore the names of God. Just as something of curiosity, when you look at the names of individuals in the Old Testament, a lot of the names will carry the name of God. When you have Daniel, the portion right here of Daniel, El, well, that's the shortened form of Elohim, which is translated as God. When you have Ayah, well, that's a shortened form of Yahweh. And that's God's name. And so sometimes when you have, Hezekiah or Jeremiah, and all of these prophets then carry the name of God. Why? Because of their respect for God. They want, their name is just more than a name. It's part of their character. It's part of who they are. And when you change your name, something that is very significant in the life of an individual. Abram, you're no longer going to be Abram. You're going to be Abraham. You're going to be Abraham. Well, this is a moment when God is giving his covenant to Abraham. He's making so special promises. A significant moment, a change of life, was good material then for a change of name as well. So Nebuchadnezzar says, well, now that you're in Babylon, I'm going to change your name. He changes his name to this, Belteshazzar. Well, what does Belteshazzar mean? It means Bel, protect his life. Well, who is Bel? It's not Yahweh. It's one of the gods of Nebuchadnezzar. And in fact, look in Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 8. It makes mention specifically that this name, Belteshazzar, reminds Nebuchadnezzar of the name of his own God. It says in verse 8, finally, Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and I related the dream to him, saying. What is it that Nebuchadnezzar is thinking each time that he says, come here, Belteshazzar? He's thinking about the name of his God. Could you imagine how then humiliating, how offensive this would be to Daniel, whose name is God is my judge. And now he's going to be named after the name of some god. As well with Shadrach. He says, it was, Yahweh is merciful, but now Shadrach means commandment of Aku. Meshach, who is like Aku? It's very similar to Mishael, who is like God. Well, now let's change it. Now we're going to say, who is like Aku? Well, who is Aku? Not the God of Israel. It's the God, again, one of the gods, of maybe the moon god of Babylon. Abednego, the servant of Nebo. Could you imagine? And can you see what is the purpose of giving these names to these young men? It's to change who they are. It's to change their character. It's to say that, you know what? You have a new life here in Babylon. That old God, guess what? I got all his stuff in my temple. He can't protect you anymore. You have new gods. You have a new life. You are Babylonian now. It may be a sly way to bring these young men in under his wing. But Daniel and his friends saw this. I think there's an application here as well, that when we are in this world, we need to have our eyes open to the influence that is around us, that the world is always trying to change who we are, and always trying to change who our young people are, our children are. How much time do we spend with our children? How much time do we give them and give them this identity of being a Christian, a follower of God? Sometimes the influence of the world is so crafty that we don't even notice what's happening. How many of us like to watch TV every once in a while? Well, I think most of us have a TV in our house, and most of us like to watch a good game of football. I'm stepping on your toes, aren't I? Most of us like to watch a good movie every once in a while. All of us like to be entertained in these ways. But we need to have our eyes opened to what's going on behind the scenes. The Hollywood is not just out there to entertain us because they want to. Hollywood's out there to influence us as well. To train our minds into thinking that certain things on the screen are right and good, to teach us a new morality, to give us new types of families, to train us into a new way of thinking, this is your new God. I don't think I can say at all, I wouldn't even say, that watching the TV ever, oh, that's sinful. But we do have to be very, very careful with the way that we are entertaining ourselves. Because whether we like it or not, we are being influenced by what we watch and by what we hear. And everybody knows it. And that's why they spend millions and millions of dollars just to get seconds of time during the Super Bowl. We have to be careful. I am influenced, but also my kids are influenced. And even in those what seem to be innocent hours of cartoons can be not just cartoons, but a new morality that is given. A new morality and lessons that maybe I'm not in agreement with, but I've put them in front of the TV because it's easy. And I've put them in front of the TV because it's a good babysitter. I need to think about what my children are watching and how my children are being influenced. And not just in the way we entertain ourselves, but just in the way, how are they spending their time? And how much time do we actually spend with our children? The sad thing is most of our time together as a family, we're sleeping. And otherwise, we're sitting together and maybe we're eating some, and we have a time where we get together and we eat, but then we go to bed and then we get up and, well, they go off to school, I maybe go off to work, and then I come home and then we have a couple hours and then we go to bed again. But really, the time that I have with my children is very, very little compared to all the influences that are around them every day. And that's kind of a scary thing. Where do they spend most of their time? Many times it's with, well, children in the school, teachers in the school. And no matter how good a light that we put on any of these influences, again, I'm not saying that public school is a bad thing, but we do have to realize that there is an influence in my child's life. And I need to know what they are being taught and how they are being influenced. Just as an example, when my wife, when she was in Philadelphia, she went to an elementary school and started taking pictures of some of the artwork that the children were putting up there in the hallways to show some of, evidently, the lessons that they were learning in the classroom. That sign says, girl plus girl equals love. Boy plus boy equals love. Do what you want. Follow your heart. Aren't these sayings that we hear all the time? Aren't these the sayings that even Disney is trying to teach our children? Follow your heart. Whatever you feel is right. You need to accept everybody. I think we all understand that we need to tolerate each other. We need to tolerate even the bad decisions of my neighbor. But under the guise of tolerance, many times is being taught a doctrine of acceptance. And not just acceptance, but celebration of sin and celebration of a morality that is foreign to God. I really feel for these kids. I don't think that they're being taught that, okay, now you need to be a homosexual, every one of you. But they are being taught a new morality. They're not just being taught ABCs. They're being taught lessons, really, that sets them up for lessons later on that are bad. Daniel, however, and his friends, it says that they purposed in their heart not to defile themselves. Look at the attitude of these young men. They were able to see through the influences of Nebuchadnezzar, and they decided to do something about it. It says in verse 8, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord, king, who has appointed your food and your drink. Now why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my own head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating at the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. Daniel had a plan, Daniel and his friends. It says in verse 8 that Daniel purposed in his heart. My version says he made up his mind. I think it's a really bland way of putting it. And in the New King James, I like that better. He purposed in his heart. He purposes for heart. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's portion. He knew what the king's command was, but he was, in spite of the dangers, in spite of the fact that he was a young man, he made a strong decision. He was going to be stubborn about this. You know, it's okay to be stubborn sometimes about the right things. He and his friends decided that they were not going to eat the food that was offered. And that might seem strange to us. Of all the things that they could be stubborn about, why food? Well, sometimes kids are stubborn about food, and we tell them to grow up. But why are they going to be stubborn about food? I think most of us, or many of us, understand about the diet of the Jews. But that God had told them and commanded them that they don't need to eat certain foods and the way that certain foods are prepared. But even still, you could imagine some of the other Jews that were present. You could imagine them thinking, well, why are you making such a big deal about this food? Other Jews who were there maybe might have been saying, why make such a big deal? Really, you're risking your life. They're going to kill you. The commander, the officer, he's worried about his own head. What about you who are being a rebellious Jew? You're risking your position. You're risking your life. You're risking the lives of others around you. And what's so bad about this food anyway? Everybody's eating it. I think you can see where I'm going with this. All sorts of excuses that you want to put in there to say that, no, it's okay this time. It's a small thing. You know, God will understand your situation. After all, here we are in Babylon, way far away from Jerusalem, and we're in a really hard situation. He's going to kill us if we don't eat this, and what's the big deal if we eat some? And really, where is God anyway? Hasn't God abandoned us, and that's why we're here in this situation? God is not going to care. This is our new home. This is our new life. What's the big deal? But for Daniel and his friends, it was a big deal. It was a huge deal. And so they were willing to risk everything in order not to eat this food. Why was it a big deal? I mean, for one thing, they could see that it was because it was the law of God. This was the law of God. And if it's the law of God, no matter how big the law or no matter how small the law, it is a big deal. Because it comes from He who will judge us. In James chapter 2 and verse 10, James teaches this principle. It doesn't matter what law of God it is. It's an important law. He's talking to brethren there about being a respecter of persons and treating one brother more importantly than others. Well, we wouldn't characterize that as a big sin now, would we? James says it's a pretty big sin. And then he says in verse 10, for whoever keeps the whole law, yes, stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but do commit murder, you become a transgressor of the law. The murderer cannot look at the adulterer and say, hey, well, at least I didn't commit adultery. They're all guilty before God. These young men knew that this small sin, this small matter was a big deal. Why? Because it came from God. It came from Yahweh. It came from the creator of the universe. And they were not about to touch the meat of the king. Why was it? Because it was more than just a strange diet. They knew that this diet that God had given to them was all about their identity. It was part of their identity and who they were. Really, if you go back to look at some of the laws that these Israelites had, you have to eat in certain ways. You have to dress in certain ways. And while some of it might have served for practical purposes, I think these laws, these dietary laws, a lot of them are just mainly to identify this people as a chosen people, a people of God's own possession. They are different. Even in the way they eat, the way they speak, the way they dress is very different. They're God's holy people. Why is it so important? Because we don't belong to this world. We belong to God. What a good lesson for us as Christians as well. We don't belong in this world, do we? Look what it says in Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3, Paul speaks about this idea that we are not citizens of this kingdom, of this world, but we are citizens of another kingdom. He says in Philippians chapter 3, and in verse 18, "For many walk, of whom I often told you, and now tell you, even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, whose glory is their shame, who set their mind on earthly things," things of this world. I don't think Paul, in these two verses, has his mind, trying to remind us of Daniel chapter 1. But it does remind me of Daniel chapter 1. Maybe these other Jews who were willing to eat the king's choice food, what could we say about them? Their end is destruction. Whose God is their appetite. Who have set their minds on earthly things. If they were willing to bow before Nebuchadnezzar in this instance, they're willing to set their identity on the things of this world rather than the things of God. But instead, our citizenship, he says in verse 20, our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of His glory by the exertion of the power that He has even to the subject all things to Himself. Do we believe that God is going to change this body into something glorious, into something wonderful? Do we believe that God is going to come, that Jesus is going to come in that day, and He's going to take us all home? And what a wonderful day that will be. If we have that faith, then we have to fight to put our eyes on the horizon, to know that He is coming, and not put all of our emphasis on this flesh and blood, because this flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom of God. That we have something so much better waiting for us. We are not citizens of this kingdom. We might be that we're Native Americans, Native Texans, but we don't belong here. We belong somewhere so much better. I think as well we need to be reminded that our identity is not just in the big things. But it's in the small things as well. How are the Jews of the Old Testament going to identify themselves? It's not only the fact that, well, they were circumcised, but it's also by all the small things that they do every day to identify themselves with the people of God. I think there's an application here as well for us. It's not just the big things that everybody sees that identifies us as Christians. We need to be reminded that it's the small things that no one sees, that maybe no one else cares about, that God cares deeply about, that identifies us as true kingdom dwellers. I'm reminded of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 through 7, where in Matthew chapter 5, he starts all talking about and giving a description of who are kingdom dwellers. Who are they? Who are they? They're people who are poor in spirit. They're people who are humble. They're people who hunger after justice, hunger after righteousness. Well, these are not aspects that you wear on your sleeve and everybody can see. These are small things, small choices in life, small choices that add up to, well, bigger choices later on, but also small choices that really say what is in your heart. Being a Christian is not about what you do here in these four walls. It's about what you do at home. It's about who you are when you're no one's watching. It's not just about those actions. Do not commit adultery. It's also about not lusting in your heart. It's not just about do not kill. But it's also about do not even be angry. But what's so bad about it? It's about a choice. So who is my God? Who is my King? And who am I going to choose every day, even in those small choices? It's the small choices that really identify us as people of God. I think as well, for Daniel and his friends, they were able to choose not to eat the king's choice food because they knew that the Most High reigns in the kingdoms of men. This is Daniel chapter 4 and verse 32. It's a very, very important verse, I think, in the book of Daniel. We'll read that tonight when we get to Daniel chapter 4 and talk about Nebuchadnezzar, his dream, his humiliation, a lesson that he needed to learn, but a lesson that Daniel and his friends already knew. Because it didn't matter what Nebuchadnezzar was going to do to them. They knew that someone else was in control. I think this is a lesson that we need to learn even today. Not just especially today, but even today as Christians. We need to remember that God is the one who reigns in this life. Really doesn't matter who is the public official over us. Who is in control? It's our God. He is the one that reigns. And as we choose Him, it doesn't matter who is chosen for public office. As we choose Him, we know that we are on solid ground. And also, last point here, God supports those who do what is right. I think that's as well a point in chapter 1, where after, not to leave Daniel and his friends in suspense, but in chapter 1, when they choose to go through this experiment and for 10 days they are going to eat nothing but vegetables and water, what happens? It says in verse 15, at the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter than all the youths. This is a good thing. They're fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. Now, this is not just some natural diet that they got on and now they look plumper and they look... This is something that is not natural. This is something miraculous that God is doing. If you just eat vegetables and drink water, you're not going to get fat. But that's what happened to these young men. Why? Because who was with them? God was supporting those who do what is right. And as we end this chapter, that's exactly what happens. At the end of the days in verse 18, for which the king specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king talked with them, and out of them, all not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus, the king. Daniel was blessed. His friends were blessed. Why? Not just because they were so wise. Not just because they were so good looking. Those were blessings in and of themselves. But because they stuck by God, and because they chose God, God chose them for great and wondrous things. We have a choice today as well. Who do we stand by? What do we choose? What kind of choices am I making as a Christian? Please take out your songbooks, and we're going to sing the song that was selected, Just As I Am. But as we sing this song, I want us to consider, well, what type of choices am I making in life? Have I really chosen God? If we're going to choose God, we have to choose God with everything that we are. We have to make those sacrifices and be willing to make those sacrifices just like Daniel and his friends were willing to make. Are you really ready to choose God? Maybe that you're a Christian, but you haven't been choosing God in your life. It's time to make that choice now, to choose Him as your Lord. Isn't that what repentance really is? It's a choice to make God your King, to make Jesus your King, that no one else is going to call the shots except for God, your Creator. Maybe you're not a Christian, but you'd like to be. You know about what Jesus did for you. You believe in that, but you're ready to make that decision. Will you choose God today? Come forward as we stand, as we sing.